This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. Here is the host of CBS's Face the Nation, John Dickerson. I got a note from a listener, John, pushing the latest January 6th theory that the insurrection was the work of federal agents, an inside job. This is based on plea deals. So apparently the story is, or the belief is, if somebody flips and testifies, this means he was a collaborator all along. So just tell me, are you hearing about this? Is there anything behind it?
No, I mean, this is so frustrating and worrying because we are in this moment where things we see with our own eyes, things about which there is mountains of evidence, that mountain is not big enough for some portion of the country. And we've always had conspiracy theories as a part of our American politics, work that I did on historical campaigns, particularly, say, the Wallace campaign. There were people who would go up into the mountains and do training against the global order that was coming to take over the United States. This always existed, but you had some portion of the public that pushed back against it. The problem now is that we've seen the riot itself on January 6th is a perfect example of it, that these conspiracies and what would be dismissible notions to be can no longer be dismissed because they can grow into something that gets people to march on Washington. So it's embedded in something that caused this insurrection is now the seeds of a new crazy theory that might spur who knows what kind of action.
Okay, so as far as you know, there's nothing behind this, but Tucker Carlson's been pushing it. I know you talk to Hugh Hewitt every day, who's sort of a mainline conservative. Does this have enough reach that we will see millions of people believing it?
Well, I mean, to the extent that Tucker Carlson has a very powerful megaphone with a certain portion of the electorate, I think you could very well see it. I think what it does is it, whether people sign up for that specific idea or not, it gives more support to the notion that, well, it wasn't that big a deal, or it wasn't what it was first claimed, or there were agents involved other than that President Trump really wasn't on the hook for it, and that the contributing factors to it are not ones associated with President Trump or his followers. It fuzzies everything up, which, you know, allows people to basically get away from the fact that the leaders of the Republican Party themselves blame President Trump for inciting the first attack on the Capitol since the War of 1812.
Well, I mean, this certainly helps Vladimir Putin. He expressed this very theory during his news conference. I'm just curious, what is in it for conservatives to push this? How does it help conservatism to basically endorse disorder?
Well, I don't think, I mean, in the traditional definition of conservatism, it doesn't help it at all. The question that's being kicked around and has been for the last several years among conservative thinkers, truly in the sort of traditional definition, in the what has sometimes been an uncomfortable alliance between the Republican Party and conservatism. You know, the modern conservative movement grew out of disappointment with the Eisenhower Republican Party. So, you know, there's always been an uncomfortable marriage. But to the extent that true conservatives, they don't benefit from this at all. But they also argue that the modern Republican Party is not driven by an adherence to traditional conservative principles, but that it's driven by a series of ideas and notions, all of which cluster around support for President Trump or support for the people who support President Trump. And so in that sense, this, again, distracts from something that otherwise, if you looked at it just based on the facts of the case, is quite damning for President Trump. And again, that's not me saying that. That's Kevin McCarthy and Mitch McConnell, who both blamed President Trump for the mob that stormed the Capitol, at least in the initial response to the storming.
Yeah. Okay, on the status of bipartisanship on Capitol Hill, Joe Manchin tried to get some Republican interest in his compromise on election reform. And, of course, there's also a voting rights bill. These will both come up for a vote in the Senate next week. It appeared to fall apart after Stacey Abrams endorsed it. That just gave Republicans one more reason to hate it, apparently. So it sounds like both of these are probably headed towards certain defeat next week.
I think that's right. On the, you know, and what we were talking about before does relate to this in a way, which is that Joe Manchin has been arguing for bipartisanship, and his fellow Democrats have said it's a fool's errand because the party with which you want to make this deal has structural pressures that will keep Republicans, will keep you from finding 10 Republicans to vote for anything in order to get the 60 votes that are required to beat a filibuster in the Senate. That there is just structurally something happening in the Republican Party that's not going to allow you to make these kinds of deals. He has said, no, the only way you can make these, you know, make progress and not destroy the system is by working in a bipartisan fashion. So he tried that on voting rights, and Mitch McConnell slapped back the compromise he tried to come up with, basically taking some of the what Democrats want to expand the franchise and what Republicans want, which is voter ID and allowing states to maintain their own voter rolls. They went nowhere, and it may or may not be because Stacey Abrams said she could go along with it. That certainly was what some Republicans said, Senator Roy Blunt among them. But the other argument, which Democrats have been making to Joe Manchin, is in the state houses, Republicans have been passing measure after measure to make it harder to vote for Democratic constituencies. And if the vote comes in and it ends up going to Democrats, making it easier for Republican legislatures to question a vote that goes to a Democratic official. That's all. Those gains are being made in the states that will help Republicans. There's no way, say Democrats, that national Republicans in the Senate are going to vote for any bill that unwinds those gains that are being made by Republicans at the local level.
Right. So why even do this? I guess to get video clips for the next campaign?
Well, I think there are several different reasons. First of all, Joe Manchin is a Democrat in a highly Republican state, so he can't be seen to do what Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders want to do in the Democratic Party. So, you know, he's just stylistically, he always has to be in support of bipartisanship because it's also kind of his brand, and it's the way he conceives of himself. And also, by the way, as Ezra Klein wrote, it might work. In other words, if the only way to get something done is with 60 votes, now, again, there's a counter argument to this, obviously, but the only way to get something done is with 60 votes, well, then you better go listen to the other side and try and work something out. You know, there are different reasons to try and do this or ways. It doesn't mean they're going to work. And in this case, particularly with voting rights, it doesn't look like it's going to work. And Manchin has said he won't do anything to get rid of the filibuster. So at the moment, I don't see how any voting rights legislation goes forward.
John Dickerson, host of Face the Nation. Thanks, John.
Thanks, Dave. Good to talk to you as always.
In the nation's northwest corner is Washington.
And here he is, our resident historian, Felix Bunnell, who joins us every Friday for All Over the Map, which is his quick look at the stories behind the names of local places and things. And this week, the owners of Johnny's Restaurant in Fife, which closed in March of last year because of the pandemic, announced that they will not reopen. However, do not worry, because Felix tells us Johnny's seasoning salt is here to stay. Hi, Felix.
Do you ever get a prank call from someone saying, hey, do you have Johnny in your cabinet? Do you have Johnny's in your spice cabinet, Dave?
Never. I mean, I never got a call like that. And as for having Johnny's in my spice cabinet, I've not been to the back of my spice cabinet in 20 years.
Okay, well, Johnny's seasoning salt. It's one of those local products like we've talked about here before, you know, Mountain Bars, Appleton Cutlets, Farman's Pickles. And like all of those products, it's really a family story. And the Johnny's of the seasoning salt is a guy named Johnny Meeker. He grew up in Seattle, worked as a young man at the famous Crawford's Restaurant north of downtown in the 40s. He opened Johnny's Dock on Theophos Waterway in Tacoma around 1953, and that's where the seasoning salt was developed. It has garlic and sugar and salt and paprika in it. It's a special thing. People out in the Northwest know what I'm talking about. Around 1955 is when Johnny and his wife started packaging and selling it. They got a big boost in sales from having a booth at the 62 World's Fair, and they developed a whole series of other things like dressings and marinades and that kind of thing. Now, Johnny's in Fife, the restaurant that was that's not going to reopen. That goes back to 1968, was taken over by his grandson in the 80s. And Johnny's Dock also is apparently permanently closed. Looks like that parcel of land is being sold for major redevelopment. And Johnny was a larger-than-life character. He smoked cigars and drove a red Cadillac Eldorado and came to the office practically every day up until the time he died at age 96, about 20 years ago. Now, the seasoning salt manufacturing and distribution was sold off about a decade ago. It's a separate company still known as Johnny's Fine Foods. The president and CEO is a guy named Kevin Ruta, who I spoke with yesterday. He reassured me that the permanent closure of the restaurant has no effect whatsoever on the seasoning business. He said the seasoning salt and this au jus mix they have are their two biggest sellers. They've got an office in Tacoma. They do a lot of manufacturing around other parts of the Sound. Now, I asked Kevin Ruta to tell me the secret recipe for the seasoning salt, and he wouldn't share it. I was surprised, yeah. He said when they bought the company, you know, 10 or 11 years ago, part of the sale included all the secret recipes. And I really fixated on this, as I sometimes do, and got him to describe this sort of three-ring binder with all these sheets inside. Some were handwritten, some were typed. And this is something you think would be in a vault, right? But Mr. Ruta said he hasn't seen the binder for a while and told me it's probably somewhere in his desk. Not exactly the Coca-Cola recipe being hidden away in the vault.
I was going to ask you, why don't you go for the Coca-Cola recipe?
Yeah. You know, and another thing, those Applets and Cotlets and Bartell Drugs, these local companies that have sold recently because the next generation didn't want to take over the family business. With that in mind, I asked Kevin Ruta, you know, he's in his late 60s, if he has any sons or grandsons named Johnny who might be willing to take over the business, and he said no. But can you guess what Kevin Ruta's middle name is, Dave?
No.
It's John.
Kevin,
but he has
John.
No plans to name it, rename everything Kevin Johnny's. But so I think it's in good hands. I think Johnny's seasoning salt's now sold all over the world, and it's here to stay.
Now, Johnny Meeker, is that the Meeker family?
No, it's spelled differently. It's M-E-A-K-E-R, different from Ezra Meeker. It's a totally different set of Meekers. But yeah, a very famous Northwest name in different sectors.
Felix Bunnell, all his features at MyNorthwest.com. Have a good weekend.
You too. Thanks, Dave.
Supreme Court. The big news out of the court this week was the decision to keep the Affordable Care Act in place. But there are two other decisions that got less attention. Let's bring in CBS News legal analyst Thane Rosenbaum. One of them was about charges against two food companies, Thane, Nestle and Cargill, who were sued for allegedly buying cocoa beans from farms in Africa that used slave labor. This is a big deal for a lot of people I know who are still boycotting these companies because of their alleged practices. What happened? Why did the court rule in that case? And why did this even come before the U.S. Supreme Court?
Good question, Dave. Good morning. Well, there's a statute called the Alien Tort Claims Act. Sounds like an interesting statute, and it is, because it basically says if you're an alien, right, if you're from another country, you can use our courts to sue our people, even though in theory you'd have no jurisdiction or claims over them. But we give you an opportunity in some circumstances to avail yourself of this provision that allows you to file a tort claim. So these former slave laborers of these two chocolate companies said, look, you aided and abetted the companies that enslaved us because you bought chocolate from them and we worked as slave wage people. And mm-hmm. So we're making ourselves available to this, but there are certain carve-outs, exclusions. And one of them has to do with sort of human rights abuses, which means that, you know, the United States is always worried about that. That's why we didn't join the International Criminal Court, because we always assumed if we subject ourselves to the jurisdiction of courts that take human rights abuses, they'll sue us, right? Mm-hmm. They'll sue us for racism. They'll sue us, you know, for perpetuating wars. Right. So that's why people are always surprised to learn the United States doesn't really join a lot of these other outside treaties that deal with these adjudications, because they don't want to be in this position. And the human rights violations were one of those. In fact, it came up before with Holocaust survivors in the United States who wanted to use American court to sue foreign companies. And because it dealt with human rights abuses, the Alien Tort Claims Act didn't apply.
So what did the court rule in this case?
It just ruled that the case, it ruled essentially against the slave laborers.
Saying they were not enslaved?
they're saying you were enslaved. We're just not giving you access to our courts to seek damage.
Okay, so they did not rule on the merits. So we still do not know whether these companies are guilty or not.
Well, yeah, and by the way, that's a good point. It's one of the reasons why you can imagine why the court is loath to make these decisions, because how do we know, right? Yeah. How do we know what was actually happening in some other country? We can't send the FBI to find out, you know, so that's another reason. The point that you're making is a good one. How do we know?
Yeah. And this seemed to be pretty much the approach the court was taking this term. The decision on the Affordable Care Act did not rule on the merits of the act. It was simply saying, since the tax penalty was withdrawn years ago, no harm, no foul.
Yeah, Dave, you didn't go to law school, but you know how this stuff works pretty good. Yeah, you're right. That case was decided, not what they say, not on the merits, right? The Affordable Care Act was decided on a procedural defect. What's the defect? You weren't harmed. You don't have standing to be in our courtroom. That's a procedural dismissal, right? There are other kinds of one, and another kind is called mootness, right? Which is the case doesn't really exist anymore because the law was taken away. So there doesn't, it's moot. And this was one on standing where they're basically saying, if the tax is zero and you violated the tax, how are you harmed if it's zero? Right. And because it's zero, you at this point, you have no complaint with the Affordable Care Act. People who wanted to support the law said, no, the Supreme Court should go much further than that. It should say the law is absolutely constitutional, so we don't have to get into this matter again. But they didn't do that. They did what you said. They narrowed the issue to a procedural defect.
And from what I understand, this is this really has upset Justice Alito. And in fact, it was an article in Politico this morning saying that the fault line in the Supreme Court is not between the right and left. It's among the six conservatives, some of whom, like Alito, don't want the court to just sort of punt on these issues.
Yeah, Dave, it's a really good point. I was telling CBS listeners all throughout the day after the election that Alito was also essentially stomping his foot because he saw this coming where the change to the election laws were going to blow up in everyone's face. And a week before the election, he said, whoa, all of these changes that were put in place for the election because of the pandemic, I'm not sure they're constitutional because they were put in place by courts and election officials and not by state legislatures. And if this gets taken up after the election, this is going to blow up in our face. So maybe we should fix it now. It's exactly what you're pointing out, Alito, things. Why don't we just make a very strong declaratory statement of what the law is instead of literally punting away and kicking the can down the road? And you're right. Alito has been consistent in a number of cases just like that.
CBS legal analyst Thane Rosenbaum. Thane, thanks very much.
Anytime for you. Bye-bye, Dave.
A recent surge in gun violence may be linked to the pandemic. In fact, the pandemic and what it's doing to our brains may be fueling all kinds of risky behavior and bad decision-making. Here's Cairo Radio's Heather Bosch.
Clinical psychologist Dr. Kira Mosseth notes COVID-19 was first discovered in the U.S. in early 2020, and it's still with us. She says people are exhausted mentally and physically.
Because we're exhausted and because people's limbic system, which is the emotional center of the brain that's responsible for sort of that regulation, we are dysregulated. And as a result of that, it's easier for people to act more impulsively.
This comes at a time when there's been a marked decrease in depression and anxiety linked to the pandemic, and COVID restrictions are being lifted. People are ready to have a little fun. In fact, our brains are wired for it.
There's a pleasure center or reward center neurochemically in the brain that is responsible for releasing and processing dopamine. And dopamine is that neurotransmitter that people crave because it makes us feel really good.
And an exhausted brain that wants to feel good is not necessarily a good combination.
Because we're not as regulated, we aren't as able to say, yeah, you know, I don't think that makes a whole lot of sense, or maybe not right now, or maybe that's a little too risky and I don't want to potentially hurt myself or someone else.
Let's throw another wrinkle into this. We are entering the summer months.
There tends to be more aggression during the summer months when the temperature increases. There's a relationship between temperature and violence as well. And people are out and about and doing more things, coming into contact with other people. So risks just generally can tend to go up in the summer months in that way.
So what do we do? First, try to get some quality sleep. If putting aside the TV and cell phone and crawling into bed sooner isn't helping, talk to your doctor. Second, take a breath.
Try and take a little bit more time before you respond or before you make a decision about something.
In other words, give your whole brain time to weigh in on the decision. And third, turn your attention to other things that give you that so-called natural high.
There's lots of activities that people can do that also activate dopamine and serotonin, which is another helpful neurotransmitter that make you feel really good without being unsafe.
Heather Bosch, I feel a little guilty complaining about a situation where, you know, my commute to work is 20 feet. But I will tell you the feeling I've had, Colleen, is sort of, I don't know, call it guilt, right? That I'm sitting around at home, you know, doing a little news, talking to you, and then I just go about doing other stuff, right? I haven't felt particularly lonely because I have contact with, you know, with friends and family. What I will say, though, is the times that I've sort of abused the privilege and just stayed up late figuring, oh, I'll be okay tomorrow. Not a good idea.
No, never with the morning shift. So what you're saying is that the pandemic has not been as stressful on you as it has been, as Heather reported, on others, and that makes you feel guilty.
Yeah.
Sure. I can understand that. I mean, same thing here. You know, when our company was talking about, okay, we've got to, you know, make sure that we stay financially fit, so we're not going to be doing merit increases this year. It was like, okay, fine, because nothing has, you know, we're talking about the unemployment rolls going up in the hundreds of thousands. I kept my job. I kept my paycheck. An extra 1-3% is not going to affect me. And that made me feel guilty. We had a great Christmas. So what I've been trying to do is just offer support to other people financially. Where I need help is the mental aspect of this, being a parent, a working parent at home, homeschooling the kids. That has been the biggest stress on me. And it's, my mental health has declined severely because of this pandemic. But I'm working to make it better. And you know, I'm here today.
Well, it looks like you're coping pretty well.
Well, that's the thing about mental health and mental illness is that it's easy to mask how you're feeling. So I think I say that and reveal that on air so that if other people, you know, are listening and they're like, man, how does Colleen do it? This and that. Honey, I'm not doing it.
Okay.
So you're not alone, and go get help if you need it. There are therapists on video conference right now. And that means it's time for your daily dose of kindness, sponsored by Heritage Homecraft. A woman from North Carolina spends almost all of her free time helping kittens. But the cats she's saving are probably a lot smaller than you may be thinking. Gia DeAscentis founded the, let me make sure I enunciate, Itty Bitty Kitty Committee. She tells WYTV she is rescuing kittens from being euthanized.
Job, but it's very rewarding.
She says it's a tough job and very rewarding. 4 years ago, DeAscentis got a call from a friend who found kittens just days old, and the mother was nowhere to be found. She quickly learned it takes a lot of work to get tiny days-old kittens healthy enough to survive.
This is such a time-consuming job. They need fed and they need stimulated to go to the bathroom, so they can't go on their own yet, every hour and a half, 2 hours. So it's a round-the-clock job.
DeAscentis became an expert and took on the role of cat mom. That's how Amy Rigby, the owner of Rebel Rescue Ranch, found
her. We needed an actual specialized unit, which became Itty Bitty Kitty Committee.
And it was awesome because, like, she found me online because I had been doing this for about 2 years before we met.
That call turned into a partnership, allowing for both the rescue and adoption of saved kittens.
We're two single women trying to save animals, and I thought
the cat population.
Yeah, I thought let's combine forces and we can help more if we help each other.
Last year, they saved 63 kittens. Each one needs about 5 or 6 weeks of care before they can be adopted. DeAscentis is hoping to get more people involved to help save even more. If you come across kittens, she says you should wait 3 or 4 hours to see if mom returns before intervening. And I suppose they would like everyone to start their very own itty bitty kitty committee.
Yes. From the G and Ursula Show on this Father's Day Eve, here is G Scott. So what do you expect for Father's Day? How do you want your loved ones to honor you?
Some peace and quiet.
Is that it?
No, perfect. Let me get some peace and quiet. And let me just get a good meal. And let me get a dad, you're the best.
Aww. Don't you get that every day?
No. Oh. I got kids, bro. Kids don't tell their parents they the best every day. They only tell them the best when they need something.
I see.
You know what I mean? So in this case right here for Father's Day, by the way, it's going to be a scorcher. So it's a beautiful weather. You just want some good to eat. Some kind of special meal, some words of affirmations about how great of a father you are.
What's your special meal? Or as Rachel would put it, what's your last meal?
I don't really I don't really. My favorite meal is homemade macaroni and cheese. So that that's my answer every single time. But I try try to stay away from that as much as I can. So I don't know. I heard yesterday that we have reservations at 1 o'clock. So that's gonna be something that's different, because that's like a Mother's Day thing, right? Like mothers like, oh, extravagant. We have reservations, and then Father's Day is like, hey, we're gonna put some hot dogs and hamburgers on the grill.
Is it okay to give a dad flowers for Father's Day?
Not me.
No, huh?
No. I mean,
do you want flowers, Dave?
I'm just curious. I'm just trying to, you know, equalize the two parental holidays.
Yeah, dude. I mean, look, shout out to everybody that wants flowers. That's cool. Mm-hmm. Just not me. I don't want flowers. You can give me some socks, give me some underwear, something like that. You know what
you mean? Know why I don't want flowers? Because it just creates more work for me and a mess in the end, right? Like you have to change the water, you gotta make sure it doesn't grow algae, and then the flowers rot and they smell, and it's just like
But here's the thing though. I will say that in you guys' opinion, is it easier to buy for someone for Mother's Day or for Father's Day? What's easiest? Okay. I think it's easier to buy for dads for Father's Day. It's simple.
Really?
Mother's Day is like, you want to stay away from buying. You don't want to buy clothes. You don't want to buy shoes. You don't know if you want to buy jewelry. And so now you just end up, you don't know what to get Mother's Day. But Father's Day, come on now, easy.
Hmm. Well, if it sucks, yes. I had no idea that was okay, but sure.
I absolutely love socks. Hey, Colleen, why is it, though, for Mother's Day, like, everybody knows when it's Mother's Day. Like, it's like 3 weeks, and everybody's talking about it.
For good reason.
And we
bring life into this world. We carry it for you, destroy our bodies, continue to give of our bodies after that parasite is born, and then, you know, take on all of the household chores. And that's not to say there aren't single fathers out there like yourself, who did all of that on his own.
Why did you just say that women take on the household chores?
Because research and studies and every single society look into the society has proven that we often take on more of the domestic duties than men.
I don't know about
any other questions, G?
G, yeah. Like I said, it excludes single fathers like you.
Yeah. Well, no. So
there's
now we
always
get, so we now get to the next part of it where it's like everybody, like that Monday, Tuesday, probably Wednesday of that week, it's like, oh yeah, that's right, it's Father's Day this weekend. I totally forgot.
That's right.
And somebody's listening right now, and they're like, yeah, that was me this week.
Right.
A lot of people forget. Some matter of fact, somebody just thought about it right now that it's going to be Father's Day on
but
Sunday.
Did you know that Father's Day was created in Spokane?
I didn't know that.
The very first Father's Day was celebrated in Spokane. I believe it was 1910. Yes, when I was a reporter in Spokane, I learned this. I shared the history of it on my Twitter page this morning. So it has local ties as well.
Mm-hmm.
All the more reason.
Well, let me complain. Can we have a holiday when it's not when school isn't out of session, when everybody's just gone doing their thing? Because I want the teachers to make the kids make the dad's Father's Day stuff. So I want school to be in session.
That's a good point.
You know what I mean? Like when I was younger, we always were like, okay, boys and girls, you're going to make something for mom.
For mom.
And everybody came home with it. Yo, move Father's Day into April.
I think you have your next crusade.
Hey!
There it is. G. Scott with Ursula, 9 o'clock this morning. Thank you, sir.
All right, guys.
Seattle's Morning News. This is Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. Colleen, of course, knows all about raising kids. But I'm guessing that since you never... it's been a long time for me. But you were particularly intrigued with Christina Hilsberg's book, License to Parent, because Christina, you were a CIA spy.
That's right.
And you're married to a former CIA spy as well, your husband, Ryan.
That's right. We met actually on a CIA field tour.
How about that? I can't think of anything more romantic. And you have how many kids you're raising together now?
We have 5 kids, ranging from toddler to teenager.
Yikes. Okay. Wow. So you have a full house. License to Parent implies that there is something to be learned about child rearing from spycraft. So explain that to us.
Well, we start a lot of these tactics very young. You know, one of the things we talk about in the book is introducing the idea of adventure bags with our toddlers. And that's one of the first ways that we start planting the seeds of, you know, being prepared for emergency scenarios. And, you know, Ari, my son, who's almost five now, he got his first adventure bag when he was like two, three. And he calls it his Indiana Jones bag and takes it on hikes, and he's got Band-Aids. He is your guy. You know, you get a boo-boo, Ari is there with his Band-Aid. And it's kind of starting that mindset from early on. And of course, those adventure bags evolve into something more sophisticated the older the kids get. And that's something we keep in all of our cars, and we call them go bags and have different types of materials as we get older. So that's one of the ways that we start to introduce it when they're young.
So they know about the 10 essentials, but you don't want to make them paranoid, right? So I notice you call them adventure bags. What do you tell them about how to behave in an emergency without scaring them?
Well, we talk about, you know, thinking on your feet, the ability to think critically, and that's so important, and it's woven throughout the book. But probably one of the most important concepts we teach them, and it helps us be more comfortable letting them do things too, is an idea called get off the X. And that's something that the CIA teaches in training. And the X can be anything. It can be a person, a place, an environment. And it's going against that human curiosity to look, you know, go forward. Oh, you see something interesting up there. Let me go get a closer look. No, it's listening to that gut and actually moving away from that danger. And we start emphasizing that at a fairly young age with our kids, because we want them to not be in a situation where they have to fight for their life. Of course, we talk about self-defense in the book, but that's worst case scenario. That means they didn't get off the X. And that's not a situation you want to be in. You want to spot and avoid danger and get away from it as fast as possible. And part of that, we talk to them about things like listening to alarms and warning signals. You'd be surprised how many survivors of 9/11 took time to do things like close down their computers before they evacuated. So it's teaching our kids to respond urgently to those things. It's teaching our kids to ignore authority figures in emergency scenarios if necessary. You know, we look at the South Korean ferry disaster and all of the kids who perished in that accident because the voice over the intercom said to stay put, to stay in your rooms. The kids who didn't listen, you know, the non-rule followers, those are the ones who survived. And so we want our kids to be able to think critically and avoid those dangerous situations.
That is the last you just mentioned, probably one that hits most home for me, because I have a little defiant 8-year-old who, you know, you want to instill kindness and politeness in them, but also not nice where it will hurt them in the end, because we're taught in public school and from growing up that you respect authority, you respect your elders, this and that. Too often we see young people go along just because it's an adult. So that's really important. Is there anything you see like in an everyday situation, like at a playground or at a farmer's market, that a parent today could really easily employ right away before reading your book?
Absolutely. I think one of the great lessons in the book is giving our kids financial responsibility from a young age. So in addition to the adventure bag, our kids get a little money pouch when they're young. And actually, you know, Ryan is so multifaceted. He also makes leather. And so now they get one that they make with daddy. And so that, you know, they feel more invested and they take their own money. And so if we go to the farmer's market or we're going somewhere and they want to buy something, well, that's on them. You know, do you have your money pouch? Oh, you forgot it. Sorry. Or actually, sometimes I will offer them a loan and I will teach my 4-year-old, okay, I'll buy you that sucker, but you're going to have to pay me for the sucker plus interest when we get home.
Interest.
And that's a concept that we introduce early on because we want them to learn these principles. And that's something that stems from CIA training as well. They give you a great amount of financial responsibility right off the bat. And we want to teach those same concepts to our kids.
Wish I'd thought of that. I could have made so much money off my kids. So just practical day-to-day stuff. At the mall, do you let them wander off on their own or do you have them on a leash?
We do let them wander, of course, once they're at a certain age, and even not even just the mall. We actually would drop them off in downtown Seattle with a map and let them explore the city for the day. And, you know, of course, those ages will vary based on when people feel comfortable. Obviously, we're not doing this with our 3- and 4-year-old. This is right. With our teenagers. But I think they were 9, 11 and 13 at the time, the first time we let them do it. And, you know, it's giving them that freedom to explore. But, you know, we feel more comfortable letting them do that because we have emphasized all these skills with them, like get off the X, preparing for emergencies. You know, we talk a lot in the book about situational awareness, security awareness. You know, when they have those skills, you find that over time, they're more capable than you thought, and you're becoming more comfortable with the idea of more freedom.
What are you talking about? Weapons?
Oh, I was just going to say, do your kids carry weapons or are they taught self-defense?
So we do talk about weapons in the book, but I always start by saying I am not saying that parents have to carry weapons or give their kids weapons. And of course, if that's something you keep in your home, please, please, please keep them locked up in a safe to only which you know the combination. We do talk about weapons as tools in the book. And so we talk about how we introduce our kids to knives at a young age. And I'm very transparent about the fact that this is something Ryan and I do not see eye to eye on. And I share a story of how he bought Ari, I think he was still three at the time, a knife in Europe. And he didn't give it to him, but he came home and he said, "Look what daddy got you. You just can look at it, but you can't have it till you're older." And I just kind of let it float. And then after I was less emotional when we went to bed that night, I said, "You know, you went rogue." We talk about this in the book when one of us goes rogue and does something that was not pre-coordinated. And I said, "I am not ready for him to have this." He's like, "Well, I didn't give it to him. I just showed it to him." And I said, "Yeah, but now you've made it exciting and I'm just not there." Right. So it's a process for the two of us because we don't always see eye to eye. But the way Ryan introduces it is the fact that when he became a father, he came to grips with the fact that he's not always going to be there to protect his kids. And so he's introduced, you know, knives as tools at a young age and taught the kids how to whittle. And he starts out with, you know, whittling sticks to roast their marshmallows on. And it's, you know, more like that. And it's a gradual approach. And then as they're older, they learn that those could also have dual uses. But what we emphasize in the book is that if you're in an emergency scenario, you don't need a knife or a weapon. You can use anything as an equalizer, right? Like you grab the lamp that's next to you. I could grab this very hefty microphone if someone come in here, right? Mm-hmm. Or you grab a chair. There are ways to improvise. And this gets back to having kids think on their feet and think critically and being able to improvise.
Christina Hillsburg is the author of Licensed to Parent with her husband, Ryan. Christina, great to meet you. Thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
Well, that was it. They are fascinating parents. Would you let your kids wander downtown Seattle at 12 and 13?
Yeah. I think so. At 12 and 13? Yeah. Well, not certain parts of Seattle. Ooh, that's a deep question. I have to think about that more. I feel like my oldest is responsible enough now at 8 to handle herself. And so at 12, 13, I think she'd know how to, do it.
Yeah. I don't know. Jury's out on that. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. We're happy you're here.
And you can keep up with the show and find some of the stories from today online at MyNorthWest.com.